History is full of bizarre, unsolved mysteries. And over time, these stories have been bent by rumor, warped by social media, and twisted into legend. I'm Michael May, and on A Study of Strange, we dig into these real mysteries and seek the truth, as close as we can get anyway. Recently, we've covered true crime cases like the Greystone Mansion murder, the Red Lipstick Killer, and America's first reported serial killers. Of course, every now and then we also dive into the odd, esoteric, and paranormal, including vanishing people, haunted locations, and UFO history. So if you like your mysteries historical, or if you love a good debunking every now and then, search A Study of Strange wherever you listen to podcasts. And remember, the truth is always stranger than fiction.
If I had met somebody who was like a role model, like Bobby Flay, who looked like girls would like him, or, you know, Gordon Ramsay, these guys are very charismatic. They're almost like movie star-esque themselves. Like, if I had met somebody like that early in my cooking days, I might have gone down that pathway.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
Hello, my friend. Welcome back. Another episode of Story and Craft, and I appreciate you stopping back by. And if this is your very first episode, well, thank you so much for checking out the show. Really enjoy sitting down talking story with some intriguing folks every episode. And today, no different, sitting down with actor D.B. Sweeney. He's got a new film, Protector. But you probably know D.B. Sweeney from The Cutting Edge. The movie came out with Moira Kelly about a hockey player and a figure skater getting together for the Olympics. Also, Eight Men Out, the baseball movie. In fact, he was with Thomas Jane in that film. And Thomas was just on with us a few weeks back. So also talking about his work with Francis Ford Coppola, his work as a chef. It was a great chat. Really enjoyed it. Hey, do me a favor, if you would, make sure to follow Story and Craft, whatever podcast app you use, just follow. Like the show. Helps people to find it. Also, do me a favor, check us out on Substack. That's right, Substack. You may not have Substack, and that's totally cool. And if you're like, Mark, I don't need another social media platform, I get it. Trust me, I'm kind of the same way. But the cool thing, Substack, it's kind of the epicenter of what's happening right now with a lot of independent media making that migration. But I like it because it makes it super, super easy to follow Story and Craft. You get an email in your inbox every time a new episode comes out. You can even use Substack to listen to the show if you so desire. Just go to storyandcraft.substack.com. And of course, everything you want to know about the show, past guests, just go to storyandcraftpod.com. It's all right there. Okay, so let's get after it. Today is D.B. Sweeney Day on Story and Craft. So where are you at today, my friend?
I am in Dripping Springs, Texas.
I don't know where that is, and I'm in Texas.
Yeah. Oh, you are?
Yeah, I'm on South Padre Island. Yeah.
Oh, great. That's a beautiful place. Yeah, I am in, it's just southwest of Austin. It's sort of, you know, it's what Austin used to be, and now it's
back when it was a little weirder, I guess. I love the bumper sticker, you know, keep Austin weird. Is that where you live now, or?
No, I just, my in-laws are here, and my nephew has, he's got his last, he's a senior in high school, and he's a big soccer player, and so this is his last sort of really meaningful game, so I just came in to see the game.
Very well. You're a good uncle. You're a very good uncle. Now, where you live full time?
Nashville.
I don't know why this is registering in my mind, but were you ever a Chicago kid, or am I just imagining?
Yeah, right. I moved to Nashville 3 years ago. Before that, I was about 8 or 9 years in Chicago suburbs, Hinsdale.
Okay, good, good, good. Yeah, so I know a lot of folks are, actually, it's funny, Nashville and Austin seem to be where a lot of people are moving from L.A. Never made it up there, man. I've always wanted to, so. But no, man, I'm really glad you have a chance to sit down today. I've been, you know, I was just talking to, I could say it was the other day. I'm at an age where the other day could have been 6 months ago, but I was talking to Reed Diamond, and we were talking about Memphis Belle. And I talked to him every time we talk, I always bring up Memphis Belle. But that was the first, I think that was kind of the first time I became aware. I might have seen something before that. Did Cutting Edge come out before or after that? The chronology is.
About 2 years. I think Memphis Belle was 90, and Cutting Edge was 92.
Memphis Belle, that was such a cool movie. And he said y'all did a kind of a boot camp or something to that effect, that y'all all kind of got together before filming, and y'all were, I don't know if it was training or, but was it something like, am I imagining this or did y'all do something like
that? No, it's true. It's true. I was a little bit, I had already come off of Gardens of Stone, a Vietnam movie, and I had trained to do Lonesome Dove and learn. So in other words, I arrive kind of ready for my movies. And so we got over to England and they had us spend a week or 10 days with these retired British SAS guys, which is like their Navy SEALs. And, you know, my uncle was a navigator on a B-17. So I knew every inch of the plane. And I had already gotten hold of like a VHS tape from Boeing of like how to fly the B-17. So like I was brilliant. And I also knew from my uncle, there was no they gave a survival course with the SAS guys. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's irrelevant because my uncle was a great mathematician. That's why he was picked. So they picked little guys for the B-17 who were extremely smart and they had basically no military training. They were sort of like a bunch of scientists. And then of course they would be trained on the 50 caliber machine gun and so forth. But I was
Why do you think that is? Is it because the targeting, the bomb dropping is in the mathematics behind that? Is that the reason why?
Or? Yeah. I mean, the B-17 was an advanced piece of technology at the time. And one of the great things that I found out in researching it is that, you know, the idea of the Death Star in Star Wars, like this big spherical thing, that was actually the battle formation for B-17s. Like the guns are set up so that they fire in all directions. But when the planes are massed together, all the fields of fire are covered. So that Death Star was actually kind of based on, you know, what B-17s would try to do in flight when they were, because they have to go so slow and steady in the last few miles before the bomb run that they're sitting ducks for fighter planes in flak. So that was part of why they had to have so much gunnery that was, covering all the different fields of fire.
Wasn't your character in the film, weren't you a PR person or something that to that effect, and you kind of wiggled your way onto that flight? Is that kind of
that was John Lithgow's character, and the great John Lithgow. But no, I was a navigator, and I had a crisis of courage. You know, I thought it was one of those rare times in my career where I got to pick apart. Michael Caton Jones, the director, and I had met previously, and he came to Hollywood and he said to me, you know, pick apart, and then I'll cast the rest of it around you, which was really fun. And I thought,
Well, see, as a Gen X kid, I seem to remember that being sort of one of the first films all the young Gen X actors, where they played, you know, in the 80s, they were young guys. This was kind of the first quasi-adult thing, like Sean Astin and, you know, and of course, you're back with Matthew Modine again in your new project here. But kind of geek out as a Gen X kid about Memphis Belle. I keep trying to, you know, every time my kids are in town, I want to show it. I can't seem to find it online, or I think I found it the other day. It's on like Amazon Prime. You have to pay for it, but that's not a big deal. But my son has never seen it. And I said, you got to see this movie. It's such a great film. And, you know, it's kind of universal. It's like, you know, the kids can get into it. The adults can. So it's kind of not really, it wasn't a kid's film, you know, but it had all the actors who were the kid actors of the day. But I was trying to remember, I don't recall, but you weren't really in any of the Gen X films of the 80s. You weren't, if I recall, I don't think you were ever really in them. Am I correct? Or maybe, you know.
Right. I was kind of Brat Pack adjacent. You know, I was.
I was going to say the word adjacent. I'm glad you did, because it kind of felt like you were there, but you weren't really in the films. But you joined up with the guys that were in those films. That was really cool. How long was the filming on Memphis Belle?
We were there about 5 months altogether. I think we had like a couple of weeks before training and stuff. But the filming itself was really fun because we had 6 B-17s that were operable and flying every day. And then 12 Messerschmitt German fighter planes and 2 camera planes. So it was a really old school flying circus. And they didn't have enough people to man the guns. You know, you had to pantomime the guns when the planes were flying. Uh-huh. So they let us all go up on the planes when you didn't have dialogue days. You'd just go up and fly around on the planes until one of the planes crashed on takeoff. And then everybody was grounded.
Was the plane like lost, or was it just, you know, like a broken gear or something like that? Was it a legit crash, or did it just kind of get banged up?
The legend is that plane was owned by the French government. One of the planes was owned by, or two of them were owned by the British government, one by the French government. And then three of them, they had a thing called the Confederate Air Force, which was an organization. And then one was privately owned. So the one that was owned by the French government, they had French pilots and everything who spoke very little English. And the legend is that these guys were instructed to break the plane because the French government didn't want to be in the B-17 business anymore. So they 300 feet and then brought it down, I think harder than they meant to. And, one of the great ironies of, magnesium, the planes are made out of magnesium, which is the most flammable metal that I know of. But that was also the lightest metal at the time. So they're all made out of magnesium. So it caught flame, it caught fire, and it burned up to nothing in about 12 minutes, 14
wow.
minutes.
Wow. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the Confederate Air Force. When I was younger, they had the Don't Mess with Texas campaign, don't litter or whatever.
Right.
And they had this one scene where basically you see a car on an open highway coming over a hill, and all you see is the car, and somebody throws out like a soft drink, like out the window. And then coming up, I mean maybe 100, at most 200 feet off the deck, you have a B-17 flying up over, like coming after the guy. It was a crazy, but I think some of them are actually based down here at, I believe, Harlingen, the airport down here. I think they have some of them. But I'm an old aviation nerd, so I could talk airplanes all day. But that was very cool. No, I had to geek out on that a little bit and kind of riff on the Memphis Belle thing. The other thing I thought I was going to mention to you, I thought I kind of made it as a voiceover guy when I first, I'm trying to think back. This is about 19... I don't know. I'm not going to pretend like I know the year, but you do a lot of voiceover. And of course, you remember back before all the voiceover demos, and for people who aren't really keyed into voiceover, you have to have your 1 minute demo showcasing your stuff. And they used to send out CDs. And I remember the first year I was with, I think it was CESD. I think you were with them. I think that was the agency. And I was like, D.B. Sweeney. I was like, oh, I've made it. I'm on the same CD demo with D.B. Sweeney, So, but you've been doing that in narration for some time. What I got to ask as a VO guy, what are some of the projects you've done that are kind of marquee that you think
the best job I ever had was being the voice of Bud Light. I did one audition where I said, for the great taste that won't fill you up and never lets you down, make it a Bud Light. And they took it and put it on 120 commercials over 10 years. And I just, that paid my bills for a long time. And
I was about to say, those checks probably took care of some business. Yeah. That's nice.
They still had residuals back then. And that was fun. And then I was the voice of Lincoln Cars for about 5 years. And
Oprah really?
Yeah, that was fun. You get a free car to drive. You don't get to keep it, but that was fun. And then Oprah Winfrey had me as her the original promo voice of her network, which was really fun. And now I'm in year 14 of Mountain Men on History Channel, which is a really great show. It's about all these guys and gals that live off the grid and kind of catch and skin their own food and make their own clothes. And it's really cool.
You said 14 years?
14 seasons.
Geez, that's in voiceover terms, that's ancient. Like, that's a long time to have one gig. Yeah. Those promo gigs are fun, though. Oh, I mean, I've done a couple of networks, and that's so much fun. And it's pretty good money, but it's just, I've been doing that for years, and there's such a change in the industry happening right now, which I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole, but
not much work in that area anymore. It's a lot of it is either no voiceover or else like one line or something.
Now, do you have a studio set up at your house that you do all the work?
I have a little remote system that I travel with. And I've had a studio in my house since I lost my competitive advantage during COVID, because during COVID, everybody had to have a studio where you were not in the business. But before that, a lot of people would have to go to their agency to audition, and having a studio was a competitive advantage.
Going back into the origin story, though, I know you said you live in Chicago, but is that where you grew up? Is that where you're from originally?
No, I grew up in Long Island, New York. My dad was a guidance counselor in high school, and my mom was my mom, and didn't know anybody in showbiz, and just sort of got into acting from a theater point of view. Like, I went to NYU, and I started trying to do plays there. They never cast me, so I had to do my own plays with my buddies, and which was really a great experience. Learning how to hang up the lights, and somebody's got to do the sound, and set up the chairs, and hope somebody comes. And so it was really kind of like for the love of the game type experience. And then I started, I got a few jobs in theater, and then I got a TV job. I was on Spencer for Hire with the great late Robert Urich. And
Okay, that's a flashback. Did I see somewhere you went to Tulane?
I wanted to be a baseball player initially. I went there. I was injured, and then I switched to NYU.
Down in New Orleans?
Yes.
I lived for 22 years down there. My daughter, a couple of years ago, my son just this past year graduated from Loyola, which is like throw a baseball, you could hit it. But they had this thing, is funny, they could go share the cafeteria at Tulane. So they would always go over to Tulane to go eat, so it's kind of a neat little ecosystem over there. I got to know, what was your favorite part of being down in New Orleans?
Well, I started cooking when I was about 13 years old in restaurants on Long Island. So by the time I got to Tulane, I'd cooked in about 7 or 8 restaurants, and I walked into Galatoire's in the French Quarter and asked for a job, and they hired me. So I cooked there for about 3 months.
Really? Which people not in the know, just going to Galatoire's or Antoine's and say, you know, hire me. That you got to have some bona fides. You got to have some street cred. But wow, so you cooked at Galatoire's and you went and played baseball. Wow. So did you have aspirations of going pro or?
Yeah, sure. Like, you know, like every kid, you know, I mean, I was a good player, but I don't know if I was good enough for that. But, you know, everybody's life takes the path that it takes. So maybe I would have been a double-A player or something and never quit and had a different destiny. So, everything happens for a reason.
But what position did you play?
I played right field and I played a little second base. And then later on, I played a season in Australia and I played third base there a little bit. Third base and left field. Switched the other side.
When you were Tulane, there was no theatrical aspiration going on. It was just baseball?
Yeah. I took an acting class on the side, and I was sort of dabbling around that idea a little bit. But it wasn't like, oh, this could be a career or anything. Because I didn't know anybody in show business. It didn't really seem like a viable pathway.
Did your folks, what was their input? And you said, hey, mom, dad, I want to do this acting thing. Was it well received? Or were they like, yeah, I don't know about that?
You know, I had done this one play in high school and they gave me an award at this university where they had a competition for the high school plays. And so, I mean, it wasn't like the craziest idea, but, you know, they were very supportive in general that, you know, but I think they were sort of hoping, you know, I'd either be a chef or I'd go to law school or I'd do something where, you know, I would be secure.
Well, even a chef, that's its own ecosystem and lifestyle. I mean, I got to know, though, what's your signature dish? What's that one thing that you, because I end up talking food at least once every show. What's that one thing you make? I don't want to say you're known for, but something like your friends know, hey, you know, let's go over to DB's house.
If you eat beef, I make a steak au poivre, like a steak with a green peppercorn sauce. It's the best one you've ever had. I guarantee it. And then if you're not a meat eater, I love to make spaghetti puttanesca, you know, which is, again, disqualifies. Some people don't like anchovies, so it's not for everybody. But that's my favorite thing to make because it gives you that salty and that like umami flavor if you do it right. So those are my top two, I would say. But I pride myself that I can pretty much cook anything. You know, I can either figure out, you know, break it down what they're doing or, you know, and plus now with the internet, I mean, every recipe is available and it's just a matter of trying it more than once. That's the part where people, I think, lose their way. It's like, you want to learn how to make, you know, chicken marsala, just make it 10 times, like follow the recipe. Yeah. And then just what went wrong and then change something. And because, you know, when you work in restaurants, you have so many reps, you just get better and you learn hacks and you learn how to, you know, temperature control and things like that. So I love cooking. I mean, that'd be my bucket list would be to have my own restaurant someday.
I think that'd be so much fun. I mean, I love cooking, but I mean, the reality of running a restaurant is just, you know, gives me anxiety, but it's always the simple stuff. I remember talked to Alton Brown a couple of times, which I kind of dig what he did for the whole culinary thing on TV. But he said that no matter how many times you make rice, like 1 out of 10 times, you completely jacks it up. So no matter what level you're at, you're going to, you know, it's just get out there, be not afraid of making mistakes. But the thing food TV did, I think, is people could watch it being made as opposed to following some linear on paper recipe. I'm not a baker. I'm more of a cook. I'm kind of like, what do I have in the kitchen? Let me heat the pan up and just start throwing things and see what happens. You know,
you can't ad lib with baking. And my daughter's a big baker and she's great at it. Very precise with her measurements. But I prefer like saute and broiling and other kinds of things because it's a little bit more feel based as opposed to like recipe based.
Do you have just one daughter or?
My son is 24. He's a software programmer and my daughter is in college, pre-med. She wants to be a dermatologist.
If you like to cook, I mean, when my kids are growing up, some of the best times were in the kitchen with kids, you know, is cooking and just getting them involved. And my kids are little foodies. I think you could appreciate this. You know, my daughter did a semester, my youngest one who's 20 did a semester in Europe. She was in Germany, in Berlin, London, and then Milan. And she's trying all the food. You know, I always told them, try it one time. If you don't like it, you don't have to have it again. Maybe try it another time a year or two later. But she's a foodie. She's into it. But the thing is, she sent me a picture. She was on Lake Como in Italy. And she says, guess what I'm doing? And she sends me this picture. So what? She's like, I'm eating tiramisu from McDonald's. You know, so it's kind of so her thing was every time she's goes some every country, she wants to eat at McDonald's just to see how McDonald's can be different in every country. But she never eats it here, you know, so it's the wildest thing. But of the restaurants around America, if you're to say you're going to sit down with some friends, what is kind of on the Mount Rushmore of places you like to eat. Where are the places that you've been? In Chicago's got some great places that you really enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, Chicago Cut is great. Gibson's is great. All the, especially the airport location for Gibson's. La Scala, I love that place. There's just so many. Club Lago, you know, I mean, Chicago has a lot of great neighborhood restaurants. I like to eat Italian food more often than not, so there's no shortage of those, you know. I just can't think of a bunch of others right now because, you know, when you're not in that area. But, the best restaurant wherever I am is my kitchen.
Kind of the same. Isn't it disappointing when you go eat somewhere and you're going, I could have made this better at home? You know, and it's one thing if the atmosphere is really great and, you know, the service is great and you can kind of relax and it's like a cold beer. But sometimes you go, it's like the service is just kind of meh, you know, and the food is like, well, I can make this better at home. It's so disappointing, you know. It's not that you're arrogant. It's just like, I know I could have made this better, you know. Yeah. Now, kind of going back, you know, you got this trajectory. You did the baseball thing. Then you're up in New York and you dove into the acting. When did it click for you? You're like, this is the thing I want to do. This is the bug really bit, you know. Was it when you were in New York?
Yeah, when I got a part in a Broadway play, a very small part in the Kane Mutiny Court Martial. Somebody left the play that was already running, so they didn't audition everybody and their brother. It was about a dozen guys got brought in to audition. And I was basically the bailiff in a trial, almost no dialogue. But I had to understudy another role that was a very funny role in the first act, like where a sailor is very nervous. And so that was my understudy role. The last week of the run, you know, the actor playing that part, Scott Burkholder, left the show and I took over that part. And so I got to do 7 performances of a really good part on Broadway. And I was like, you know what? I think I can do this. Like I got a different response than other actors who had played the part before me. And I felt like I was really in control of the audience in a certain sense. And I was like, wow, I think I know what I'm doing.
Was there more of an affinity for on stage or on camera?
I had only done theater. And so I didn't know anything about cameras or that all seemed so foreign. Like the theater seemed like, you know, as a New Yorker, I'd been to Broadway plays. It seemed like that could be something attainable. But the whole idea of Hollywood was not even on my radar until Francis Coppola picked me out of nowhere and made me the star of his movie Gardens of Stone opposite James Caan.
Did you have a sense of the gravity when you did that? Like, okay, this is Coppola. Were you enough of a film aficionado where you had like, okay, this is a Coppola film. Did you really get the weight of it at that age?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, I had 2 callbacks. I met Fred Roos, the late great casting director who cast everything from The Godfather to The Outsiders. And, you know, he discovered Jennifer Connelly. Like the list of the people that Fred Roos, Harrison Ford just acknowledged him at the Screen Actors Guild Award. Fred discovered me and put me in front of Francis. And, you know, I did well. And then 3 weeks later, I had a callback. And then they flew me to Washington from New York, where I was living. And it was like, it was between me, apparently, according to the driver gossip, me and 2 other guys. They wouldn't say who they were. And so I thought, well, it's going to be somebody like Matt Dillon or somebody from The Outsiders or Rumblefish or Mickey Rourke or, you know, it's going to be all these other names that I know of people that were in the business already. And I wasn't really in the business. So I started lobbying Francis and Fred to not play the lead role. I wanted to play a smaller part because I just wanted to get in. I wanted to be in. I just thought, I don't want to go down to the goal line and lose the part to Matt Dillon or whoever, you know? And so anyway, they had already decided they were going to use me. And so they thought it was very charming that I was like lobbying for a smaller part. So, but that's where my head was. I was like, just get me in the movie and maybe I'll get another bigger part in another movie.
It's like, just get me in the game. You know, that's kind of that, you know, same kind of like baseball mentality. But well, to the baseball thing, I mean, the 8 men out. In fact, I just talked to Thomas Jane just a few weeks ago, actually. But was that like, I'm a baseball guy. I could jump in here. I can do this thing. Was that kind of your angle on that? Or how did that land in your lap?
Well, I really admired John Sayles. I thought he was a great filmmaker. And I knew the story of Shoeless Joe Jackson. And I just thought, you know, Robert De Niro and Anthony Perkins and all the other people that had played baseball players up to that point had been terrible. Gary Cooper was laughably bad as Lou Gehrig, athletically, great actor. But I thought, oh, I could be the first guy to actually ever believably play, you know, a pro-level baseball player in a movie. And but, you know, Kevin Costner was making Bull Durham at the same time for the same studio. And he was a college baseball player. And so anyway, so they were released first. So Costner actually, I think, became the first guy ever to believably play a baseball player in a movie. And so I got to be second.
When I was 18, I abused my press passes. I was working at a radio station in Dallas. I was a big Nolan Ryan. I'm a big Nolan Ryan guy. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to do a project. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to do an interview. And that was back when George Bush Jr. was one of the owners. And it just so happened that that was the same time they were filming JFK in Dallas. And so I was just out there on the field, you know, of course, abusing my press passes. And then I look and it's, and on the back of the jersey said Costner. I was like, wait a minute. So they got him out there during the pregame to kind of warm up. But I'm curious who your, you know, who your baseball guy was. You're coming up, you know, was there somebody, or was there a team? Was there a player who was just like your guy that you followed all the way through?
Yeah, Carl Yastrzemski. And I was a Red Sox fan because of Carl Yastrzemski. And my plan as a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old was just to play left field for the Boston Red Sox. So, you know, that was as far as I had any, you know, career aspirations, that was it for me. And so I really always enjoyed watching him. And then I got to play golf a couple of years ago with his grandson, Mike Yastrzemski.
Really? Now,
yeah, so that was really fun. But, yeah, I huge baseball fan. You know, when I first started going in Hollywood and, you know, I didn't really want to go to the Oscars or anything like that. Who cares? The Golden Globes. But I can go to the World Series. Let's do it. So I used my whatever juice I had to get tickets for baseball games and hockey games.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to satisfy your inner 13-year-old and do stuff.
Steven, we need to tell people about Nice Games Club, our game development podcast.
Okay.
You know, the one where we talk programming and design, but also how games fit in our culture?
Yes, I've heard of it.
Mark, what else can we say?
How about how we
have more than 400 episodes in the archives? We've interviewed folks behind Monkey Island,
Baba Is You,
Opus Magnum,
and more.
If you say so.
But you two also make games, right?
Speak for yourself, Lydia, but also yes.
So we don't just talk about the industry, we also talk about the games we're making.
Yep,
that's it.
Nice Games Club. Listen at nicegames.club or wherever you get your podcasts.
Where were you at? Like, you know, you've done this, you work with Coppola, you did Eight Men Out. What was on your mind as far as trajectory? Were you wanting to do action stuff? Were you in a drama, or did you like character work? What was kind of your chosen trajectory if you could have done anything at that time?
Well, I had a moment in the sun there where I was a flavor of the month, and I didn't jump on like any big Hollywood movies that, you know, that were offered to me. I made a bunch of small movies. I went to Denmark and made a movie about the Danish resistance to the Nazis. I made another basketball movie in Chicago. I wanted to prove that I was versatile and that I could play other parts, because, you know, it seemed to me like a lot of movie stars, especially, they just do the same thing over and over again. And while that's very lucrative, it wasn't very interesting. I like the part about in theater where it's like, all right, let's try this part. You know, I put on a nose and you're different than you. You know, that was the appealing part of being an actor to me.
I do have to touch on the cutting edge, because that seemed like, I don't recall that being big in the theaters, but I recall it somehow on cable afterwards. You know, it seemed to have a second life. It seemed to kind of take off after it actually had its theatrical run.
Yeah, that's exactly right. MGM was in financial trouble. And they didn't have the money to release the movie properly. They released it 5 weeks after the Olympics, in which Tonya Harding tried to break Nancy Kerrigan's leg. Everybody was focused on figure skating. It was the perfect time. If they had released it in November or December that year before the Olympics, it probably would have lit the world on fire in theaters. Instead, it didn't do such great business. But on VHS, it just exploded. And, you know, I had people that owned Blockbusters and places like that tell me that they had, you know, gone through like, you know, 15 copies of that movie that it had been on rental for 3 years every single night, you know, 10 copies per store, whatever the case was.
Really?
And DVD, same thing. People just, so it's, it, and now it's more than 30 years old. And every 4 years when the Olympics come around, it has a big resurgence. And so, yeah, it's
really, really. Yeah, I remember having a crush on Moira Kelly after that. And then I ended up interviewing her for, I think it was called With Honors. I think it was about 94-ish, roughly, with Brendan Fraser and Joe Pesci. And it's weird you say 30 years. I'm like, really? Was it 30 years ago? I'm at that age now, I guess, where you kind of say, okay, well, this was, I guess, been around for a minute, you know. But you could say, you know, you had your moment in the sun. You had, you know, a moment, or I think, Fraser, your flavor for the moment. What was kind of in your heart, like, okay, voiceover is a thing for you. What was the ultimate kind of like thing, if you could frame it like, this is the thing I would like to do, you know, more voiceover, more maybe directing, you know, what was it at that time?
I just wanted to, you know, be a like a character actor in leading roles, you know, like Gene Hackman was one of my idols. And I just thought, if I can just work and continue to be solid in everything and then kind of get rid of my baby face and be like middle-aged, then all of a sudden I can be Popeye Doyle and the French Connection. And I can, you know, play some of these, you know, that era of movies was so great in the 70s and even into the 80s where, you know, real men were in the movies and now everybody's, you know, I mean, these, I don't want to throw anybody particularly under the bus right now, but if you look around at the movie stars we have right now, they're all soft and, you know, they're metrosexual kind of guys. And, you know, we used to have Lee Marvin and, you know, and Robert Duvall, we just lost. All these guys were like actual dudes, you know, who could do stuff.
There was a shift in the 80s. You mentioned the 70s. There was a big tonal shift between 70s and 80s movies, you know. So the vibe of the 70s movies is kind of the not necessarily action movies, not necessarily comedies, but, you know, films with more depth. Is that kind of the stuff that turned you on when you were younger?
Well, yeah, I don't know necessarily depth. Like, I loved all the French New Wave, not all of them, but I love the French New Wave style. I love the whole, there's a graininess to the film. So a lot of these films are shot, you know, in Super 16 or other, you know, like very sort of edgy kind of, you know, presentation, the way they're photographed. People were, you know, they were just the more countercultural sort of characters, you know, anti-heroes were coming up in many different movies. And it was just a great era for movies. And unfortunately, it's kind of ended. You know, I mean, movies now are very generic and there's very few filmmakers that have a distinctive style. I mean, you know, Tarantino, Christopher Nolan, maybe there's three or four others that don't come to mind right now. But back then, you know, you had Friedkin, you had Coppola, you had Scorsese, you had Robert Altman, you had all these directors that had, you know, you could pop in one of their movies and be like, oh, that's a Robert Altman movie. That's a Scorsese, you know, and, you know, we've lost that for many reasons, but mostly it's the economics of it, because Cutting Edge, which we talked about before, was, I think it was about a $17 million budget in 1992. And so that would be like a $50 million movie now. Nobody makes $50 million movies because they can't compete with the $300 million Avatar movies. And so movies tend to be like budgeted under $10 million or over $100 million. And the sweet spot is halfway between those two, because then you have enough money to pay good actors. You can still have a car chase like Bullet, you know, but the economics just don't support that range of budgeting, which is where all the great movies came from.
Yeah, I spoke with somebody recently and they said it has something to do with the international market. Like, comedy here doesn't necessarily translate overseas. So they don't really, that's the reason why we don't see as many comedies as we once did. But, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I was just talking to Thomas Jane and he has a thing. He loves film noir, you know, like things you don't really, you know, see that much. I'm not saying I'm a big consumer of that, but it is, you know, it is kind of cool to stumble across a random film. Like, there's so much stuff on streaming, but I don't know if you're like me, but I'll search through Netflix or Amazon Prime, whatever. I'm like, there's literally so much stuff that 13-year-old me would be like, this is awesome, but nothing I really want to, you know, sink my teeth into. And then sometimes you just stumble across something. A lot of times it's something older, you know.
Yeah.
But have you had any aspirations to direct? I mean, kind of going forward, what's kind of on your agenda now that you, on your bucket list that you still haven't done that you would really enjoy doing?
I directed a feature, Two Tickets to Paradise, with John C. McGinley and Ed Harris and Moira Kelly about 17 years ago. That is out on all the platforms now. I also directed a short with Sean Austin about 5 years ago called Two Dumb Mix, which lit the festival world on fire for a little while, won like 80 film festival awards. And it's a 5-minute slapstick short. And I've directed a lot of theater, and I'm preparing a movie right now that's a Western that I've been working on for a long time. But I don't want to jinx it because we're close. But hopefully I'll be shooting that this year.
Did either one of your kids have aspirations to wanting to do what dad does, or were they like, no?
No, my daughter is a very good singer. And, my son actually was approached a couple times to do like modeling and stuff. But, you know, he was a hockey player. And I didn't really bring them to the sets because most of the child actors that I encountered were spoiled. And I didn't want my kids to, you know, fall into that. Where, you know, all of a sudden they realize if they throw a tantrum, 40 grownups will bring them a Snickers bar. It's just not, it's too much power for a 9-year-old or a 12-year-old. So I kept them out of that world. And, you know, it's also, it's a dark place. You know, I mean, that phrase, I sold my soul to the devil to get famous. I mean, that's not metaphorical for a lot of people.
you know, when you're looking at kind of the arc of your career, it's like, you know, because of course film, you have to go, you got to go to makeup, go to the trailer, do, you know, there's a whole thing. Voiceover, you just go step in your booth and you could be in your underwear technically. What is about VO that you really enjoy? I'm asking because me doing it for so many years, I'm kind of curious for a fellow VO guy.
Well, you know, it used to be very lucrative and it's still a good, you know, side hustle, but I like the whole, I love the radio. When I grew up listening to radio dramas and, you know, obviously they were no longer, I'm not that old that I was listening to the radio dramas live. I have to go find them and so forth. And there were various places where you get them late at night, Bob and Ray and stuff like that. Phil Hendry, I was a big fan of his.
Before we get going, I have something I call my 7 questions. It's quick questions, a little extra get to know you. And of course, the first one, we've already talked food, but I always ask, what's your favorite comfort food? You've had a crap day or a really awesome day. It's just something that always just kind of lands for you.
Pizza.
Well, for a kid who grew up in Long Island, but also lived in Chicago, I got, you know, what kind of pizza?
Oh, well, you know, it depends what they got. I mean, I'm not a fan of the deep dish pizza, really. My favorite pizza is on Staten Island. It's a place called Danino's, and they have a clam pie there that is just to die.
Wow. I never even contemplated putting clams on a pizza before. Now, the next question, if you're going to sit down, you got 3 people. You're going to be talking story for a few hours. And living or not, who would those 3 people be that you would like to sit down with?
You mean to talk about?
Yeah, just, you know, you're just going to be sitting down, coffee, just talking for a few hours.
Oh, well, we got to start with Churchill. You know, I don't think there's a better storyteller than Churchill and, you know, just a figure. I'd like to have him there. And then who else? Teddy Roosevelt, maybe. That'd be good. Those guys could get into a little bit of an argument. And then let's see, Sophia Loren. You know, let's have a beautiful woman there that they can try to impress.
Now, if we were to go back when you were a young guy, who was your very first celebrity crush?
Cheryl Ladd.
Was she on Charlie's Angels?
She replaced Farrah Fawcett on Charlie's Angels.
Oh, that's right. God, that's going back. Now, the next question I got for you, if you're going to be going and live on an island, you know, it's somewhere exotic, somewhere you want to be, but no streaming. So you got to bring one DVD because you want some movie you can watch over and over again, and a CD or a box set of music you can listen to over and over again. What would the music be and what would that movie be on that island for a full year?
Well, the music's easier for me. I think I would just take Dire Straits, all their music. Mark Knopfler, if I can include his part with Dire Straits, because he's so versatile and he's so skilled. And I love it. It goes from like serene to like, you know, rocking. And mm-hmm. So I love Dire Straits. I put them in my movie, Two Tickets to Paradise. The music, not the guys. And, but as far as like the movie, you know, it's funny. When I was filming Gardens of Stone, in Washington, I had a VHS player and the original Dune with Kyle MacLachlan and Virginia Madsen got locked in my VHS. So I watched it like 30 times because I couldn't get it out. So, but that was a great movie. It's very underrated. Like all these new Dune movies are out there, but something about that David Lynch version of Dune was really, it had more of the weirdness embedded in it.
It did have a weird, almost a daydreamy aesthetic to it. Working with James Caan, though, because he's, you know, he's a Jewish kid. He's our tough Jewish dude. You know, do you have any quick anecdotal thing about James Caan spending that much time working with him?
I got to know him better after the movie was over. This is a known thing, so I'm not like outing him or anything like that, but he had a really bad drug problem. So he was, you know, he was kind of amped up all the time. And I don't think I really got the best of him during Gardens of Stone, but then later on I got to spend a little time around him and, you know, he's a very funny guy and, you know, very like guy's guy. But during Gardens of Stone, I was in a tricky situation because I was new and I could have used a little bit more mentorship, but I got it from Dean Stockwell and James Earl Jones. So it all worked out.
Now, the component parts for you, perfect day. If you're, say, from the time you get up to the time you go to bed, if these things happen in the course of the day, it's a perfect day for you. What would those things be?
Well, I really love, I'm a big coffee guy. So I've been making French press coffee lately and I sort of made a study of it and just trying to get the perfect, you know, brew. So I start every day the same way. I get up, I make my bed, I read the Bible for 10, 15 minutes while the coffee brews. And then I drink the coffee. Then I try to do all that stuff before I look at the phone. And then I'll see if there's anything urgent on the phone and, you know, try to answer whatever is pressing. And then, you know, I like to exercise, you know, if I can right there, work out. But a lot of times I'll work out later in the day because I like to, you know, walk on the treadmill for an hour while watching a, you know, baseball game or a hockey game or something. So those are the things I love. I mean, I love to be outside. I love dogs. I don't have one right now, but I love to get one. And but I travel so much, so it's tricky.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just working on whatever project I'm developing or learning a part or something. I love that part. The preparation part is great.
But the last couple of questions for you now, if you were to go, you know, say acting, performance, doing what you're doing now, I think you've already kind of answered this question. But if they said, hey, this was not available to you, what would be the second choice for a career, your other vocation, what would that be?
Well, if I never really met a skinny chef back when I was cooking, if I had met somebody who was like a role model, like Bobby Flay, who looked like maybe like girls would like him and he still was a chef and all that, or, you know, Gordon Ramsay, these guys are very charismatic. They're almost like movie star-esque themselves. Like if I had met someone like that early in my cooking days, I might have gone down that pathway. But all the chefs I met were sort of like fat.
All Prudhomme, yeah. But the ones who are big guys, you like, you know, you are, they were gregarious, you know, you're like, okay, he knows what he likes, you know, knows what's good. I remember watching, when I was a kid, watching Paul Prudhomme on like PBS.
Oh, yeah.
And Yen Kim Cook and, you know, and Jacques Pepin. Yeah, watched that. They were kind of like the trinity for the people I influenced my cooking early on. But now the last question I got for you, if you were to go jump in that DeLorean, go back, you're 16 years old, you got a piece of advice to yourself to either make that moment better for you or set yourself on a different trajectory, what would that piece of advice you'd offer 16-year-old you?
I think it would be, you know, buy Apple stock would be a smart thing. But just also, you know, and I think I've done this. I mean, I've really enjoyed the ride. You know, I mean, I've worked in, you know, 8 different countries, I think. And I've worked in, you know, 15 or 20 different states. And every place I go that I work, it's like a privilege to, you know, you're not a tourist. You know, you're living there with some of the people who live in the area, who know that, you know, I made a movie in Italy and I was sort of like hanging out with these guys and going to football matches and, you know, going to the local food places. So, you know, I guess that'd be advice I'd give to a young actor if they're lucky enough to get flown someplace to be on a job. Get the heck out of the hotel, you know, go hang out with the crew, go, you know, go live the life, because acting is fun, but you know, it's the life around it that it avails you of, you know, somebody's paying for your hotel room, you know, you're in Cape Town, South Africa or something, and just enjoy it and savor it. And I think I've been very successful at that.
Well, that's fantastic, because when you're younger, you don't always know to do that. You know, you don't really know how to live in the moment as much when you're younger. But if you can, and you had somebody else paying the bills and you were able to do that, that's fantastic. But so anything that you got kind of in the can that's going to be coming, or anything you're working on in the near future here?
Yeah, I shot a movie last month called Red Ink, which was it was really fun. It's set in 1949. And what made it interesting to me is that we shot it like a play. Like it's a 75-minute movie, but we shot it in like 7 or 8 long takes, like where everybody's
really
got a mark. And yeah, so I'd never worked that way. And that was really fun. And I think that's going to be an interesting movie. Red Ink, it's called.
Red Ink. And did I think I saw something somewhere. Didn't you do a project where they sourced every page of the screenplay, one page at a time from a different person or something? You know, what was that project?
It's called Boot Lake, and it's kind of a murder mystery. And but yeah, they had 100 writers write one page, and then they had 24 hours. And then the next person gets it, and they have to build on. If you get page 2, you got to build on page 1, and you know, you can't reinvent the wheel. You have to sort of stay with the flow. And it came out remarkably coherent. And the guys who were behind it were these social media guys who made a big impression during the Vines era. And you know, so it was like, you know, new way of thinking, new way of working, and we'll see how it turns out. You know, you never know. As an actor, you sort of got to jump in the pool and, you know, hope for the best.
Well, my friend, I really appreciate you sharing some time with me today. I know, you know, you're there to be a good uncle, and taking a break from that to speak with me means a lot. I certainly appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for your time.
All right, there you go. D.B. Sweeney. Enjoy the chat. Real cool guy. Really enjoyed the opportunity to talk with him. The new film, Protector, is out right now with Mila Jovovich and Matthew Modine. Just, you know, really enjoyed sitting down with DB. Hey, and don't forget, if you want to find out more about DB Sweeney, just go to storyandcraft.com.
pod.com. Click on his picture, boom, right there, all the information you could possibly want to know about him, as well as everything about the show. And if you would, do me a favor also, make sure to follow Story and Craft on your podcast app, whichever one you use. Also, Substack, check it out, storyandcraft.substack.com. It's really a cool way to stay up on what we have going on here, because you get an email every time a new episode comes out. And hey, you know, there are other great folks doing great stuff on Substack, so check them out also. Okay, so I'm going to get on out of here. You have yourself a great rest of your day, or great evening, whatever you got going on. And as I always say, thank you so much for making what I got going on part of whatever you've got going on. It does mean a lot to me. And hey, by the way, we got some really great guests coming up. A couple people I have been wanting to talk to for quite a while. So April, we got some great shows lined up. So you have a great one, and I look forward to connecting with you soon on the next episode of Story and Craft. Take care.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story.
Hey, I'm Andy from the Ultimate Trivia Podcast.
The Ultimate Trivia Podcast.
Our show is pretty simple. Five lifelong friends competing on a single topic to see who gets bragging rights. Each episode, Nick, Scott, Brian, Kelly, and I battle through 10 questions on movies, music, science, history, sports, whatever we decide to throw in the blender for that week. Every episode stands on its own, so you can jump in wherever your curiosity takes you. And we don't just stop at right or wrong. We get into the backstory, the origins, the weird facts, and the stuff that has you saying, "How did I not know that already?" So download an episode, play along, keep score, and tell us how you do. See if you can beat the crew on the Ultimate Trivia Podcast.